title.
Alright, this was the informal network. I guess the informal one is Meta Groups, Meta Bycross Products, and Alexander Forman.
Right, that's what it says. Sorry, that was supposed to be, that was my abstract. It was supposed to be Honor the Stars. But this is an informal talk.
Yes.
So,
it
can be on, what? It can be completely disorganized, and it will be. The reason it's informal is because I mostly came here along with my student Oleg to talk to Blake Winter about something else, which is vague, somewhat related to this, but not very much. And then I was asked to give a talk, so I'm giving a talk. But you see, it's even, so this is not meant to be an insult, but the handout was even prepared for something else, and it's not even ready. I'm just showing you how informal it is, okay? Anyway, what's my topic? So, or how did I come to it? So I really came to this from a completely different place. So, I'm in the middle of a program to study virtual nodes and from a certain perspective, and within it a sub-program to study so-called W nodes, and that's the topic of conversation with Blake. Within W nodes, there is some special interest in knotted graphs, so graphs that have vertices, and the reason is because they're somehow related to both the so-called Kashiwara-Wern conjecture, something about convolutions on Lie groups and Lie algebras, and also to, at the same time, to Drinfeld associators, whatever that is. And within that, I needed a playground. So I really needed to be able to actually compute things, even if in a reduction of the big theory. So that playground turned out to be related to be the two-dimensional Lie algebra. And that playground, when restricted to knots and tangles, turns out to be to give an invariant which seems to be a generalization of the Alexander polynomial, which in many ways, or which is the Alexander polynomial, but in many ways it generalizes to tangles, and in many ways it is better than anything else there is, in as much as I know, about the Alexander polynomial. So it's worth looking at. Somehow it's I don't know if the correct, that's a bit too ambitious to say about something that's been around for about a month, but it's it has many properties, it generalizes the Alexander polynomial to tangles and has many properties that no other such extension has. So it's a good extension to tangles. And at the same time, it will force me to introduce a lovely algebraic structure, which I will call a metagroup, and a little bit of sort of abstract nonsense about that algebraic structure. So that's the general direction. Now, I will follow a handout. Here it is. You all have a copy of it. And right at the start, let me tell you what the main weakness of my story is. Here it is on the blackboard. So everything is absolutely elementary. The formulas that appear here are completely elementary. This is all matrix stuff. Alpha, beta, gamma, deltas are sort of elements in a matrix, and you do silly things to them. That's actually an advantage, the fact that it's all elementary. The disadvantage is that the formulas are ugly. I accept. Okay? So the formulas do a good thing, but no denying they're unmemorable and ugly. Okay. This said, let me start with the real story. It is an informal talk. You should interrupt me. You should throw tomatoes, whatever. Maybe I should explain why we're taping an informal talk. First of all, it's been my tradition for the last 3 years or so to tape every lecture that I give. And the reason is that this way I can, tell my students, look at my talk from Buffalo. It has the answer to your question. So it's just a useful thing to do, even if the talk is informal. Anyway, so the main objects to study that I will study today are knots and tangles. Here's a knot. You've all seen such things before, I hope. You go in, you go under, you go over, you go under, you go over. That's what a knot is. I've numbered it according to time if you walk along the knot. So it's sort of position one, position two, position... Oh, sorry, two is here, three is here, four is here, five is here under, six is here over, seven is here under. At the moment, ignore these numbers, that's still a knot. That's a tangle. Tangle are a bit less famous, but they are much more important in some sense. So a tangle is a piece of a knot that lies inside a disc. So the disc here is marked with a dashed line, and I think the pictures explains what a tangle is better than 1,000 words, right? But let me say why it's important, why they are important. They are important because in some sense knots are the end products. Tangles are what generates knots. Tangles, you put together several tangles next to each other and you get a bigger knot. So any algebraic study of knot theory will have to start by studying the generators, the smaller objects. Okay? And lots of things you want to prove about knot theory. Yes.
Your previous picture, you said that was a knot, but should I imagine it's been closed up somehow?
Oh, so that's a so-called long knot.
So you're going to call it a long
knot. Okay. And I will identify long knots with knots. So you want it to be a circle knotted, you have to take this end and go through infinity perhaps and tie it to that end and connect it to that end.
But do you want your tangles to meet the knot in exactly four places, or just any number of places?
No, any number of places. So it's a disc with any number of strands, pieces of string, going inside it. Okay. And again, the reasons are valuable is because they, algebraically speaking, it's the generators as opposed to the end products, which are the knots. And many things in knot theory become simpler when you talk about tangles. So sometimes you have a knot invariant which is very difficult to compute for the knot as a whole, but if you can divide a knot into two pieces, you can compute each half more easily. So you get sort of divide and conquer algorithms that force you to understand tangles first. Okay, and likewise for proving. Sometimes you want to prove something about a knot, and it's better to start by proving it about tangles. You'll see examples in a minute. Okay, let me just add another bit. Crossings have signs, or maybe just remind you that crossings have signs, and the signs are either plus or minus, and they're determined somehow by holding the strand with your right hand so that the thumb is pointing in the direction of the flow and then looking, I don't know, something like that. Okay, there is some rule for determining signs. I don't think I want to go through it, but just remember that these signs exist. Okay? Are you still with me? Am I too loose? Okay? Now, of course, knots and tangles are not these pictures. They are these pictures modulo the so-called Rademeister moves. The Rademeister moves are the so-called Rademeister 1 move, which says that you can undo a kink. A Rademeister 2 move, which says that if you have two strands going over each other in this manner, you can slide one across the other. And the Rademeister 3 move, which is pictured here, and I will not try to describe it verbally, I think it's clear what it says. So knot theory, or tangle theory, for me, is the theory of pictures like this, or like this, modulo these relations. And maybe I should say that already here, the pictures are in terms of tangles, not in terms of complete knots. So that's, in themselves, the pictures are a reason to look at tangles. Let me also add that the Rademeister 1 move is shown here grayed out. And the reason is that it's often ignored. Often we do not mod out by Rademeister 1. And the reason is that, well, you get a nicer theory if you don't mod out by Rademeister 1. And at the same time, you don't lose much, because it's very easy to show that if a knot has a number of kinks in it, you can always, without using Rademeister 1, you can always push all the kinks to one place and then count them. And then the difference between knot theory with Rademeister 1 or without Rademeister 1 is just the counting of these kinks. So it really doesn't matter. And for today, indeed, I will not look at Rademeister 1. Okay, so still, modulo Rademeister 2 and Rademeister 3, it is sometimes very difficult to decide whether two knots are the same or not. And the usual way to go, or one way to go, is to try to define knot invariants. What's a knot invariant? It's a function that you can compute from a presentation of a knot, from a knot diagram, from a picture like this, and which is invariant under these moves, so it does not change if you do any one of these moves, so it's really a function defined on the knot rather than just on its presentation. And that function better take values in some easy space, some space of polynomials or matrices of polynomials, or something where you can easily tell if two things are the same or not. Okay? So we want to define knot invariants. And let me give you a lovely idea how to do it, which unfortunately completely fails. So pick a group G and pick two pairs of elements in the group G. Okay? Let me call them Young-Baxter pairs. Okay? The two pairs of elements will be called R plus and R minus. And R plus will be the pair G sub over plus and G sub under plus. And R minus will be likewise with minuses. Okay? And these pairs, each such pair lives in the group squared. Okay, so it's a pair of elements in the group. And the way I will define the invariant is at every crossing, well, at the positive crossings, I will put on the over strand a GO plus, and on the under strand a G under minus. Sorry, a G under plus.
Did you mean to change that crossing there?
Did I mean to change that crossing? Definitely not. I messed up. Thank you. Sorry, I mean this crossing is the same as that. Okay? And likewise, had it been a negative crossing, I would put a GO minus on the over strand and a GU minus on the under strand. And then I would just go along each strand and multiply the group elements that I see along that strand. Okay? So, for example, over here, I see, suppose you follow this strand, I see a G, this is a positive crossing, so a GO plus, and then a GU minus, and then a GO plus, and then a GU minus, and then a GO minus, basically what I've written over here. And likewise, for the second strand, well, I get a shorter expression, but it's of the same nature. And now I got two elements of the group, one per strand, and that's my proposed knot invariant. Unfortunately, it fails. And it fails because very quickly you can check that Rademeister 2 implies, so you know, I mean, it's almost an insult to check it, but well, okay. So I mean, you write it and GO plus followed by a GO minus should be equal to 1. And so basically, Rider-Meister 2 implies that GO plus or minus followed by GU minus or plus is equal to the identity. And then you look at Rider-Meister 3 and you write it correctly and you find that it implies that the remaining two group elements must commute. And then, so if everything commutes, it's just a matter of counting. You just have to count how many pluses you see and how many plus U's and how many, well, basically you just have to count how many of each kind of group elements you see as you go along a component, and it's a simple counting invariant. In fact, well, there is such a well-known such invariant, it's called the linking number, and this is even weaker than the linking number, because it does not, so the linking number, when you have a many component knot, you have a linking number between any pair of components. This does not even tell which component links with what. It only tells you the overall linking number of one given component. So it's a weak and not terribly useful example.
Image here, that's supposed to be like a column vector of...
Yeah,
orders.
It's a column vector of group elements. Okay? Now, but let me generalize, and the generalization does come out to be interesting. So, first of all, well, I want to define what a metagroup is. And a metagroup is something that, from some perspective, looks like a group, but it isn't necessarily a group. So, and by the way, I'm not 100% sure that the name metagroup is the right name for this thing. So if somebody here knows algebra better than me, or even just know the right kind of algebra, maybe you can correct me about what this should be called. Okay? But first of all, let me tell you about a perspective from which you can view knot theory, from which you can view group theory. So let's talk about group computers. So what's a group computer? A group computer is a machine that can store in its memory group elements. So here is a typical state of the memory of a group computer. Well, it has registers. The registers have names, okay? So it has register X, register U, register V, register Y, and each one stores an element of the group. So we have X column G1, meaning the element G1 is stored in X, okay? So by the way, the set of all such databases that a computer may hold and in which the labels are X, U, V, and Y will be G raised to the power X, U, V, Y, the set X, U, V, Y, okay? Well, that's just a database stored in our computer, but our computer also has operations. The operations are, well, the prettiest one, the most important one, is the operation M, X, Y, Z, where X and Y are two registers that appear in this database, or on that memory state of the computer, and Z is a label that does not occur here. Okay? And the operation MXYZ will be take the element stored in position X, the element stored in position Y, multiply them and store the result in position Z. So U and V are unchanged, and X and Y disappeared, and Z contains G1, G4. And that is a state inside G to the power UVZ. Is it Z or Z? What?
American English, it's C.
American English, it's C. Okay, good. Anyway. Now, our computer actually has... Sorry, I should have said... These operations satisfy some axioms, obviously. So for example, if you multiply X and Y and store the answer at U, and then you multiply U with Z and store the answer at V, You've just multiplied x, y, and z and stored the answer in v. Right? So by associativity, this is the same as multiplying y and z and storing the answer in u, and then multiplying x by u and storing the answer in v. So this is just a restatement of the associative law. Double slash is new speak for composition, where you compose things in the right in the right order. So, you know, you first do the writing. There is the ordinary problem with circles where composition really means you first do the thing on the right and then the thing on the left. Double slash just means the correct composition operator, the right order of composition operator. Yes.
Why the register Y disappeared?
What?
Why register disappeared?
Because these are my rules. My rules for multiplication. My rules for multiplication are: you multiply two things, they disappear. You store the answer at Z. These are the generators that I've chosen. I've actually. There is also a duplication operator operation. I will show it in a minute. If you wanted why not to disappear, you'll first make a copy of it and then multiply. Okay, so I mean that's just my choice of what are the basic operations are. You know, I'm just telling you what the machine code is.
Sure.
Computation is the same no matter whether if you use 386, you know, it doesn't matter which machine code you're using.
I just wanted to clarify because it's not the computer I'm using. So
it's just a choice of convention. There is no really meaning to it. Anyway, as I said, there are more operations. So there is the operation SX, which means look at register X and invert it. There is the operation E sub X for inventing a new register called X and inserting the identity on it. There is the operation D sub X, which is delete the register X, just remove it from your memory. There is the operation that sort of solves your problem, called element cloning. So it takes the thing written in Z and puts two copies of it, one in X and one in Y. There is a renaming operation. So you take register X and rename it Y without changing the content. Okay? And finally, there is a binary operation. And the binary operation is if you have two databases and all their labels are different, you can just take their union. A database that contains both things. Okay? And then there are many, many, many axioms that relate these operations. So one axiom I wrote here, and it's associativity of the group. Here is another axiom that really has nothing to do with group theory. Okay? If you have a pair of elements, P, then, so in other words, you have a register X, which stores G1, and a register Y, which stores G2. If I forget Y, I will be left with a machine that stores only G1 at X. If I drop X, I will be left with a machine that stores only G2 at Y. If I take the union of these two machines, it's the original, or sorry, of these two databases, it's the original database. So P is equal to the forget Y of P union the forget X of P. Now, let me tell you that this operation and that operation are different in nature. Sorry, this axiom and that axiom are different in nature. This axiom is somehow linear. It is applied to, so this is an identity of operations, but it should be applied to a data set, to some data set D. D appears only once on the left and only once on the right. This axiom is somehow quadratic, because the data set P appears, well, once on the left, but twice on the right. So it's somehow quadratic in the data set. Okay? I don't really mean it in the sense of linear algebra. Only logically speaking, the data set appears twice on the right-hand side. Okay? So what's a metagroup? A metagroup is a computer in the same way, So it has the exact same set of operations. So it has the MXY, it has the SX, the EX, the DX, it has the same collection of operations. But these operations, instead of acting on G to the power X, where X is a finite set of labels, they act on some set which I will call G sub X, which may or may not be a power of some group. But now I need these operations to satisfy some axioms, and the axioms I want are the linear axioms of before. Okay? So this is an axiom for a metagroup. This is not an axiom for a metagroup. Had this been an axiom for a metagroup, it would be a group, because this really says that G2 is G1 squared. But by dropping this axiom, I'm allowing G2 not to be G1 squared. Okay? Sorry, where I say G2, I mean G with two memory cells, and when I say G1, I mean G with one memory cell. So let me give you a few examples. Example one, number one, well, it's the tautological example, the non-meta example. So you take G sub X to be G to the X. Example number two, take G sub X to be X by X matrices with entries in, I don't care where, in an abelian group, Z, I suppose. Okay? So X by X matrices just means a matrix whose rows and columns are labeled by elements of some set of labels X. Okay? And then, what are the operations? The operations will be simultaneous row and column operations. So, if you want to merge two labels, so in other words, sorry, if you want to add two if you want to multiply the group, well, the operation mx1, x2 into y will be the operation when you take the column of x1 and the column of x2, add them together, call the result y, but at the same time, do the same thing to the rows. Okay, so it's joint row and column operations. So this will be addition. This will be the multiplication. I think I'll skip the stupider ones and maybe the duplication operation. So to clone an element, you just clone the corresponding row while at the same, or the corresponding column, while at the same time cloning the corresponding row while changing the labels appropriately. Okay? So it's quite obvious. Maybe the one extra operation I have to tell you is how to take the union of two databases. So the union is just the block diagonal composition of matrices. So I wish there was an eraser here. There must be somewhere. Basically, if you have one data set, D1, and another data set, D2, it will go to the data set, the block diagonal data set, D1, D2. And it's easy to check that all axioms are satisfied. Okay? Now, this formula is not satisfied. Let's check it. Yeah?
Because several registers in several matrices, no?
No. A matrix is the full, is a total state of the machine.
So there's no notion of, there's no, no
there is no notion of elements. That's the point. That's why it's a metagroup. There is no notion of specific elements, but there are operations. There is the operation in which you behave as if you multiply the element X and the element Y to produce the element labeled Z. Okay? And these operations have to satisfy the same axioms, but they don't have to actually correspond to elements. Okay? So, for example, let me check that Well, you can check that the like associativity obviously holds, right? I mean, if you combine three columns into one and at the same time combine three rows into one, it doesn't matter in which order you do it. Okay? But let me check that this axiom doesn't hold, just so as to show you that I have a metagroup which isn't a group. Okay? So take the 2x2 matrix, so take an element P. So an element P should be an element in the sort of storage space in which there are two labels, X and Y. So it should be a 2x2 matrix. So here's a 2x2 matrix, A, B, C, D. This is P, okay? Now really, this should be labeled X, Y, and X, Y. So this is the rows and the columns are both labeled by elements of my set of labels, okay? So what is DX of P? When you drop X, you're left with the matrix, the 1x1 matrix D, in which you have, the rows and the columns are both labeled by Y. What is delete Y in P? So now I'm deleting Y, I'm left with A. Okay? And then what is the union, so DYP union DXP? The rule for union was to take the block diagonal union. So I'll get the matrix AD, 0, 0. Sorry, when you do a block diagonal, you put zeros in the off diagonal blocks. And this is not the matrix I started from. This is not ABCD. Okay? So here is an example of a metagroup which isn't a group. Yes?
So I'm thinking of it as a category.
Yes.
Where you have what used to be registers are now objects, yes? They have some more business. Is it? But then I have a problem to understand what are the labels.
So I propose, I mean, yes, there is a categorical language to it. There is something about a sort of these are group objects in a monoidal category. But this is not terribly useful because later I'll go in a direction which doesn't have a good categorical language. But really my answer to you is I propose that you do not think of it like a category. Okay? Just think of it as I stated it, computers in which you don't actually look at the inside of the computer, you only know what the machine, what the language is, what the collection of operations are, and they satisfy, these operations satisfy some identities. Okay? I don't know what to say. Okay. There are lots of other examples, by the way. I mean, I've given you, here is one example which is of a metagroup which isn't a group, but there are plenty others. There are plenty others, maybe I'll, well, my whole talk in some sense is about one. But you see, you know, when you want to construct groups, you often need tools. So likewise, to construct a metagroup, I will need a tool. And my tool will be a meta generalization of the so-called bicross product of groups. So what's a bicross product of groups? So now I'm back to ordinary group theory. So I guess it's like a product and like a semi-direct product, except neither one of the factors needs to be normal. More specifically, suppose you have a group G, which is the product of two of its subgroups, the heads subgroup and the tails subgroup. Okay? And suppose these two subgroups have empty intersections. Sorry, so their intersection is just the identity. So set theoretically, the group G is just equivalent to the set H times T. But the operation is not necessarily the direct product operation. Okay? All I'm saying, all I'm giving you is that G is equal to H times T, where H intersects T is the identity. Well, it follows that G is also T times H. Exercise for you. It's a lovely exercise. It's not entirely obvious. Okay? So G is equal to T times H. And then G is completely determined by H and T and by the swap operation. The swap operation is the operation which maps a pair TH to the pair H prime T prime, for which TH, well, being an element of G, it can be rewritten as an element of T times H. So for which TH is equal to H prime T prime. Oh yeah, sorry, I swapped from here to here, sorry. So the swap takes a pair TH, that pair generates an element of the group, that element of that group is also H times T. So it can be rewritten as H prime T prime, and that's what the swap operation does. Okay? Now, the swap operation, is it clear what the swap operation does? Okay. The swap operation, yeah?
Some of the assumption is that this product should be unique, yes? This presentation in the form of HT should be unique.
No. I'm saying, suppose I have a group G, which is presented in this way. It is given, so I am given a triple, G, H, and T, so that H and T are subgroups of G, and G is their product, and the intersection of H and T is the identity.
So there may be some choice in defining it as swap operation.
No. Once you have fixed what H and T are, once you have fixed the structure G, H, and T, the swap operation is well defined. It's the operation from T cross H to H cross T, for which this identity holds.
So my question is
the intersection is true.
Oh, I see.
The fact that the intersection is trivial implies that any element of the group can be written uniquely as a product of an element in H with an element in T. This is completely standard, by the way. I mean, this appears in the books. Anyway, what properties does the swap operation have? So H stands for heads and T for tails, and I'll denote heads in red and tails in blue. Okay? So the operations are best described schematically. So if you have two tails, so two elements of the tail group, and one head, then you can multiply the two tails and then swap, and that should be the same as swapping and then multiplying. So the axiom is, so written as a composition, the operation of swapping 1 and 4, the operation of multiplying 1 and 2 and putting the output in position 1, so multiplying 1 and 2 and putting the output in position 1, I just decided to call this position 1, this position I decided to call it position number 1, right? And doing this product and then swapping it with the thing which I just decided to call it position number 4, should be the same as first swapping 2 and 4, then swapping 1 and 4, swap 2 and 4, then swap 1 and 4, and then tail multiply, so multiplying the tails group 1 and 2. Okay? It's completely obvious that this axiom has to satisfy. Is it? I mean, it's just, it's visually true. I mean, likewise, there is an axiom about swaps and head multiply. And then the point is that if you have a tail multiply, a head multiply, a swap operation, and a few minor things regarding the inverses, I don't want to talk about those, but these are the main thing, a tail multiply, a head multiply, and a swap operation, and the tail multiply, the head multiply, and the swap operation satisfies these two axioms and the minor axioms regarding inverses, okay? Then this picture defines, this picture over here defines a product, reconstructs the product of the original group. So the original group was presented as head, comma, tail, or by pairs, head, comma, tail. So here are two such pairs, head, tail, head, tail. If I wanted to multiply them and produce a single head and tail, the way I would do it would be to first of all swap one head and one tail and then multiply in the corresponding groups. I'm really saying nothing, you know, I'm really, really, really saying nothing. I'm just saying that if I knew how to swap things and I wanted to multiply T1, H1 with T2, H2, I would just swap these two and write it as T2 prime, H1 prime, H2, and then multiply in the corresponding subgroups. Okay? So now I told you everything about bicross products. Now, what's a meta bicross product? So, it's the thing that has the data from which you can construct a bicross product. So it's essentially, well, it's a pair of groups, H and T, but in the meta sense, along with a swap operation. So for every set of labels, now I call H the set of labels. It's a little bit of an abuse of notation. So H is some finite set of labels. T likewise. So for any finite set of labels H and a finite set of labels T, beta HT will be a set. It's a set of sort of memory states of a machine that has registered to store H elements and registered to store T elements. Along with, so it's a collection of such sets, beta HT, along with tail multiply, where X and Y are elements of H and Z is a new element of H. Tail multiplies and X and Y should be in T. Head multiply, where X and Y and Z are all the new elements of H, and a swap operation, which will just swap the register, which does the effect of swapping the register in X with the register in Y. Okay? Or rather, okay. And also all the lesser operations, which now I'm not even bothering to state, okay? So that TM and HM are associative in exactly the sense as before, and identities 1 and 2 hold. These are linear identities, so this identity should hold. This should be equal to that, where 1, 2, and 4 are arbitrary labels, okay? And then the claim is that given a meta bicross product, it defines a meta group. And the meta group will be defined by letting gx be beta of x, x. Right? So if you wanted 7 elements of the group, you will need 7 tail elements and 7 head elements. And then you will define group multiplication, or the meta group multiplication in G sub X. So you will define GM using this formula. Okay? So I just told you how to take two sort of smaller meta groups and get a bigger one. Okay. Finally, here is my meta group. Okay? Or rather, my meta bicross product, which will lead to a meta group. So, beta HT will be matrices, not necessarily square. These are matrices in which the rows are labeled by tails, by elements of the set T, and the columns are labeled by heads, okay? And there is an additional element outside of the matrix, written here, called omega. Where? Well, these H's are elements of the head set, the T's are elements of the tail set, and omegas and the alpha ij's, so these elements, instead of being numbers, they are Lorentz polynomials in variables ti, which are in bijection with the tails. Ooh, sorry. You know what? Maybe I should skip, rather than telling you the group laws, I should give you an example. So for example, the positive Young-Baxter element will be an element of beta x comma y. Okay, sorry, of the group so basically it will have one tail for x and one tail for y, one head for x, one head for y. So it's an element of the bicross product already. So it will be a matrix whose rows are labeled by tx and tys and whose columns are labeled by hx and hy, and with an additional entry here, the entry here will be 1, and most of the entries of the matrix will be 0, except there will be one non-zero entry, and it will be the variable t sub x minus 1. Likewise, for the negative crossing, for the negative Young-Baxter element, I will be putting 0, 0, and the inverse of tx minus 1. Well, anyway, now I have to tell you what the operations are. Okay? So the tail group is somehow trivial, somehow obvious. So the tail multiplication of x and y will be to just, so x labels a row, y labels a row, so you just take the two rows and add them and relabel the answer z. This is the ugly part of the talk, by the way, if you haven't noticed. This is where the formulas are ad hoc, okay? But they give a good result, so it's worthwhile to suffer through them. The head multiplication, the head multiplication is weird. So if I wanted to head multiply the column x with the column y, so now I call this column alpha and this column beta, the result is a bit non-linear. It's alpha, so you get a single column labeled z, and you get and in it you have alpha plus beta plus the norm of alpha times beta, where the norm of alpha, I mean, this is algebra, the norm of alpha is simply the sum of elements, the column sum of alpha. Okay, so alpha is a whole column, just take the sum of elements and multiply it by beta. And like all the rest of the matrix stays unchanged, so gamma here stands for a big block of things, and it just stays unchanged. The union operation, so if you have disjoint label sets, well, the union is more or less the same as before, so it's this block diagonal union, except the omegas get multiplied, okay? And finally, the swap operation, and I really have nothing good to say about the swap operation. It's a messy operation, okay? So suppose I wanted to tell you how to swap, to apply the XY swap operation in a matrix that has an X row and a Y column. Well, so really, alpha here is a scalar because it's defined by one column and one row. Beta is a row vector, gamma is a column vector, and delta is a n minus 1 by m minus 1 vector matrix. Sorry. So you first of all compute the norm of gamma, the norm of this column vector. Then you let epsilon be 1 plus alpha. Alpha is a scalar here. And then you let the new scalar that will appear here be alpha times 1 plus the norm of gamma divided by epsilon. I will not read out these. You can read them yourself, and they will not add to your understanding if I will read them out. Let me just say that the sort of big part of the matrix also gets changed, even the part of the matrix away from the head and the tails that I'm commuting, that I'm swapping, gets changed. So over here I have delta, over here I have gamma times beta. So gamma is a column vector, beta is a row vector. If I multiply them, I get a matrix. So delta minus gamma beta makes sense, but to make it more horrible, I divide by the scalar epsilon. And finally, the omega part gets changed from omega to omega times epsilon. Theorem.
So epsilon is a scalar?
Epsilon is a scalar. Epsilon is 1 plus alpha,
okay,
where alpha is this entry, which is a scalar because it involves only one head and one tail, the head
okay.
Y and the tail
okay.
X. Okay? And then here is an element of the square, sort of the group, the thing that pretends to be the square of the group. Okay? So this is, so it has, you know, well, two tails and two heads. And here is another element, element. Put these elements, now I guess I have to go back to the definition of the non-invariant, okay? So where was it? Ooh, long ago. Right. So this definition makes sense in the meta sense just as well. Okay? So take the meta group, or you know what, maybe I'll do it like in this picture. So take the positive crossing element and put it in register 1, 12, in registers 1 and 12. Then take the negative crossing element and put it in registers 6 and 13. Okay? And do this using the disjoint union, starting from the basic crossings and using the disjoint union operation. Do the same to all crossings, and you'll get a big 16 by 16 matrix. Okay, and then just multiply in order using the multiplication operations that were that came from the bicross product structure. Okay, I know it's horrible, but well, that's what you do. It's not so horrible. You'll see in a minute that it's about three lines of computer code. So. Here is the theorem. The theorem is that the resulting invariant is a tangle invariant. So if you have a tangle with several components, you'll get a group element for each, so a metagroup element for each component, which amounts to saying, so if you have seven components in the tangle, you'll get a 7 by 7 matrix of Laurent polynomials with an additional Laurent polynomial in the upper left corner. Okay? Now, in the case of knots, this extra part is the Alexander polynomial. In the case of links, or rather of tangles that can get close to links, the so-called multivariable Alexander polynomial is somewhere hidden inside it. I will not tell you exactly where, but you can read it off very easily from the result. And restricted to braids, you can, it's equivalent to the Burau representation, whatever it is. And furthermore, I guess I should have said that, it is extremely well behaved with respect to various tangle operations. So to multiply two tangles, you multiply the corresponding elements in the meta group. To double a strand in a tangle, which is a standard tangle operation, you just replace a strand by two parallel copies thereof, okay? You just use the group, the meta-duplication operation in the group. So, I mean, all good operations make sense, okay? Maybe I'll skip the y-happy, I'll just show it, because I think I'm running out of time. What time is it? Oh, it's 50, yeah, so I'm running out of time. But I'll just say that one good property of this, that even though it sounds complicated, it actually fits on one piece of paper, including the computer code that implements it. So here's the computer code. First of all, let me load some utilities. These are just printing. They have no mathematical content. And hit enter. I'm using Mathematica. I've hit enter. Utilities have been put in. Now here's the key implementation trick. The way I save a matrix, alpha ij, is by replacing it by a quadratic function. So take new values, introduce new variables, ti and hj, and just replace this matrix by the polynomial lambda, which is the sum of alpha ij, ti, hj. And the reason you do it is because all the operations becomes extremely trivial to define. So the norm of an element is you just replace all the tails label the row. And if you want to sum along the column, you just have to replace all the tails by one. So you take your element and you replace its tails by one. The tail multiply, well, the way I've defined it before, well, you just have to take the variable, the t's corresponding to x and y, and replace them by tz. That's the same as collapsing two rows into one row. The head multiply, ooh, that's a mess. First of all, I have to figure out what the column alpha is and the column beta is, and the column beta are. So the column alpha is, you take the derivative of this thing with respect to hx. And what's left is, if you take the derivative with respect to one of the h's, you just get that one single column. So alpha is a certain derivative, beta is a certain derivative, gamma is what you get from lambda if you replace the corresponding two heads by zero, and then you let the output be exactly the formula that I wrote on the previous plan. Finally, the swap operation. So I guess this is again a bit of a mess, but it completely corresponds to the formulas I wrote before. So now that all of this is settled, I hit enter and it's been entered into the computer. Now I can test things. So I want to test this identity. Well, I just take a generic element and apply to it the operations that I've defined previously in the correct order. And one way of applying it will give me this matrix, another way will give me this matrix. It's ugly, but they are the same. Okay, and it took no brain to compute it. Okay? Now I want to check Rademeister moves. Well, I compute the tangle invariant corresponding to this, the tangle invariant corresponding to this. Both are obtained by taking several Young-Baxter elements and then doing a few group multiplications, where the group multiplication was, I suppose, defined here by the same formula that the same formula that summarized over here. And again, I get the same answer. And finally, suppose I want to compute the invariant of 817. Well, I just enter 817 as a disjoint union. I get a big 16 by 16 matrix, which in order to compress it, I've removed all the many rows and columns are zeros, so I remove them. Okay, so it only looks 8 by 8, but it's actually 16 by 16. Then I take beta and iteratively multiply along the node. So I multiply 1 and k and store the result into 1, where k runs from 2 to 10. Because I just want to show you what a partial computation is. Well, that's a partial computation. That's what I get halfway through the computation. Then I do the rest of the computation, and I get a thing at the upper left. I get 0 at the bottom right, but a thing at the upper left. And that thing, if you believe another program, is the Alexander polynomial of the knot I started from. Okay? I don't have time to tell you where it came from, but it did come from some serious mathematics. The mathematics has to do with what I hope to talk to Blake about tomorrow, which is two-dimensional knots in R4. Everything actually has an interpretation in terms of two-dimensional knots in R4. And then I have a long to-do list, and I think, again, I don't have time to go through it, but I'd be very, very, very happy if I'd be able to go through this to-do list, in the next year or so. And that's my usual propaganda.
Any questions? Can you do it for other solutions to the Young-Baxter equation?
Do what?
Well, find your invariant z beta for the film.
So, it looks okay. First of all, Z is defined for a group G, for a metagroup G. Beta is a specific metagroup that's written as a meta by cross product. Okay? So, just looking at groups, in fact, there is even a lovely metagroup that somehow codes the fundamental group of the complement. So even the fundamental group of the complement of a knot is a metagroup invariant in exactly this way. Okay? Now for meta cross products, it seems that all quantum invariants are in fact meta cross products, or come from meta by cross products, sorry. Though there may be issues with how exactly, I mean, I'm saying it seems because, well, it's definitely not written, it's not fully understood, and when you say quantum invariants, it's not entirely clear what you mean, but there is definitely a sense in which out of a quantum group, you can write the meta group corresponding to a quantum group as a meta by cross product of its upper Borel and its lower Borel. So there is some of these stories, story continues to all quantum invariants.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank you again. And we'll take Joe to dinner at 6 p.m. So if you are interested, let us know.